I should start by thanking the organizers for this wonderful meeting, which brings together people from different places, different disciplines, in a really extraordinary location. I guess I never could understand why Australians always wanted to come back to Australia, but now I do. I thought Australia was sort of like the U.S., only less dense, but I guess it's a little bit more desirable. So I thought long and hard about the title of the talk. In fact, I spent most of the last 9 months since I received the invitation thinking about it, but I reached the conclusions before the talk, which is sort of helpful. And collaborators are listed here, particularly important were Sai Ghosh, who I said since was from Santa Barbara, who was a student of Tom Rosenblatt's University of Chicago. And the other particularly important people here are Neil Christensen, who did a thesis on the second half of the collaboration with so let me just start by showing that this is dealing now with real experiments of real people. These are the sort of Sai actually blowing off steam or something in the lab, nitrogen, but it's steam. Let me move straight to the outline. I'm just going to spend a few minutes talking about sort of entanglement in the context of solid-state physics and why this concept is actually useful in a dilute system. And then the second of our talk will describe why this concept is actually useful for a concentrated solid-state system. And then the last question is whether all this implies is a really helpful way to think about solid-state physics. So just to say what the theme is really to try to use some of the concepts that people have, or language at least, you know, concepts, language people are developing on this quantum information processing, and see if there's actually anything helpful that can develop when we apply these concepts in more conventional condensed matter physics. The hope is, of course, at the end, that by using some of this language in condensed matter physics, we'll be able to re-export the ideas and maybe develop new concepts for solid-state quantum computers. So that's the outline and the purpose of the talk. Entanglement is really nothing new. This audience, I think I hardly need to describe it. Of course, it's the concept is simply the eigenstates are sums of product wave functions, and it's simply the product wave function itself. And this concept is underlies essentially most of chemistry and a lot of solid-state physics, and of course underlies the quantum information theory as well. Now I'm going to describe as two systems where we believe it's actually a useful concept to understand what we observe in real experiments. The first experiments I'm going to describe are in an inorganic solid, actually just an inorganic salt, lithium fluoride salt, which has randomly inserted into it rare earth ions, in this particular case holmium ions, which basically live on some fraction of the sites assigned to rare earths in this body-centered tetragonal structure. So the bottom line is I have basically this lithium rare earth tetrafluoride structure. And there's a unique place into which either holmium or yttrium can go. And the lovely thing about the series is a completely isostructural dilution series. So I can address issues to do with these magnetic ions at any level of dilution with complete confidence that I'm not introducing some terrible lattice distortions as I go across the series. Now, this system. Is actually a very pretty system in a lot of ways. One is the crystals are actually very pretty. There's a huge amount of knowledge about these systems gained actually from a military laser project. These are actually these fluorides actually, very fluorides actually form the basis for so-called alphabet lasers, which are used for essentially high-powered applications, sort of up in the upper atmosphere. Now, the parent compound, a pure lithium volume tetrafluoride, is a very famous ferromagnet, and it was famous 20 or 30 years ago because it's in fact a dipolar coupled ferromagnet, which is exactly, even though it's a three-dimensional system, because it's dipolar coupled, the dipolar interactions with long range, it's a system which orders essentially in three dimensions at its upper marginal dimensionality. So in fact, the mean field theory with logarithmic corrections is all that's required to describe essentially all of the critical properties. This is a beautiful ferromagnet. It has a classic diverging susceptibility at a Curie point of 1.53 Kelvin. And I'm not going to belabor this any longer. We've recently had a paper out on the quantum phase transitions in this material and how they are affected by essentially decoherence from nuclear spin degrees of freedom. That's a separate talk, which I gave at Phil's last meeting, so I'm not going to bore him with that this time, bore him with something else. So let's now talk about what happens in this dilution series, and this will also motivate why we are interested in this. Of course, as we heard in a previous talk about dipoles, dipole interactions are anisotropic. Of course, you remember that the dipoles, you play with refrigerator magnets, knows this, is dipoles, you know, which they're displaced basically along a direction that's parallel to the easy axis of the dipole, when the interaction tends to be ferromagnetic, whereas if they're displaced perpendicular, the interaction tends to be antiferromagnetic. And so in this case, there's an easy axis which is fixed by the crystal field levels. It's the c-axis of this particular for this particular structure. And so I have Isaac dipoles situated at all these holmium sites, holmium rare earth ion, the non-filled shell. And so there's a huge magnetic moment, the G equals 14 doublet ground state, which is Ising-like at each holmium line. It's actually not trivial to show that the ground state of this for this crystal is ferromagnetic, but it is. It was actually shown by Luttiger as his thesis in the late 40s. Another famous result of Luttiger says why certain dipolar systems actually have ferromagnetic ground states. Not true. In any case, it disagrees with Luttiger's theorem about that. And what's interesting, though, is that theorem holds in the Luttiger-Tisa theorem holds in the case where you have an ordered system. But the moment that you start removing magnetic ions, in other words, replacing magnetic holmium ions with non-magnetic yttrium ions, the fact that the dipole interaction is actually has different sign depending on whether you're axial or equatorial actually asserts itself. And in fact, removing this particular yttrium ion actually introduces an effective antiferromagnetic interaction between these two holmium ions. So there, in fact, the equatorial interaction then asserts itself. It's then easy to see that this ferromagnetic ground state, as you throw in enough yttrium ions, introduces enough defects into the ferromagnet that you lose the ferromagnet. So first, of course, you don't lose it. You just simply see sort of classic behavior you expect for a dilute ferromagnet, where you're simply pulling out magnetic ions. And in fact, this behavior persists down to about 50% dilution. So this is just showing you some data showing the magnetic order parameter down here as a function of temperature, and the magnetic susceptibility up here as a function of temperature. You're seeing the divergence at a reduced Curie temperature, just as you would expect for a system where the physics I just had in the last few graphs weren't happening. But things get more exciting as you go to lower concentrations. In particular, if you're left with only 17% of the rare earth sites occupied by magnetic ions, actually you get classic spin glass behavior. And this classic spin glass behavior has manifested itself here. This is a magnetic susceptibility taken as a function of temperature. showing that there's actually thermal hysteresis, meaning that we see different susceptibilities on cooling and warming. There's also magnetic field hysteresis, plastic spring loss-like behavior. What's curious, though, what puzzled us for a long time, is why was that when you went from x equals 0.167 down to 4.5%, which isn't actually very much, because remember, this is a three-dimensional system, so the cube root of these two numbers isn't terribly different. The distances between the ions isn't terribly different in these two cases, by something like a factor of 1.5. What you discover is actually there's no longer any hysteresis. You just simply see this very nice looking peak in the susceptibility for this particular frequency, which is about 50 hertz, which is slightly above the exact Kelvin. And so, make a long story short, let me just move on very quickly, because I don't want to spend too much time. Because if you look at the space diagram that you can draw as a function of dilution, okay, you start off with a pure ferromagnet at 100% holmium, and then you evolve across the space diagram out of the ferromagnetic phase into a spin glass phase. And then over here on the left-hand side, you evolve into a state, actually, which is no longer a spin glass. It's some kind of a phase, actually, which behaves as you cool down, as you cool it down more and more, behaves actually in a less and less glassy way as you cool. Because, of course, the spin glass becomes more and more glassy as you cool. So what happens down here is what we dubbed a number of years ago the anti-glass phenomenon. Now, why is the anti-glass an interesting thing, and why is it so unexpected? Of course, if you think about the dipolar interaction in an insulator like this, there's absolutely no screening. Dipolar interactions go like 1/RQ, and at all levels of dilution, the ions will be interacting. These are not exchange interactions which essentially die off within a few nearest neighbors. These are interactions which never die, and they decay actually relatively slowly as a function of distance. And so the fact that actually as you reduce the concentration over here below a critical value, you know, somewhere around 10%, that you actually lose track of the spin glass behavior is very, very anomalous. You would think that with these long-range interactions, all that's really happening as you go to larger dilution is you're just simply losing track of the fact of the details of the lattice. You're just dealing with essentially a pudding which is full of these randomly located dipoles which are interacting. And in fact, again, ages ago, there was a paper by Amon Aharoni and Erling Pitta from IBM, stating that at all concentrations in a random dipole coupled system, random system of classical dipoles, you should always enter a conventional spin glass state at low enough temperatures. The fact of this is that we're not finding them. So, what is this anti-glass state and why does it exist? Of course, you could guess from the title of this conference that it may have something to do with quantum mechanics. But let me show you some characteristics of this anti-glass state. The first one is simply the zero frequency susceptibility as a function of temperature. And what you'll remember, of course, from your school days is that if I have a set of free ions in an insulator, the magnetic susceptibility is just scale like 1/T. It's just a Curie law. And what's interesting in this system is that it obviously has interacting ions. In fact, the zero frequency susceptibility is not a Curie law, but it's simply a modified Curie law. Curie law, in fact, has been modified to a power law, scaling by T to the minus gamma, where gamma is actually 3/4. And this behavior actually works over nicely over the lowest two decades of temperature here that we can access. Now, there's some peculiarities here, though. So I have this smooth-looking specific heat and a smooth-looking susceptibility, but when we go and measure the specific heat of the system, something rather odd happens. In fact, in specific heat, which you see is not a smooth variation, not a smooth power law, but a series of very sharp peaks. So this is very, very odd. Usually, in sort of a classical system, sharp anomalies in specific heat are associated with sharp anomalies in the susceptibility. There's something very unusual going on here, just in these essentially low frequency properties. And what you normally have, of course, if you have sharp specific heat peaks, is you have some kind of classical level scheme, which will consist of let's say pairs of spins, and these specific heat peaks might correspond essentially to the breaking up of these pairs. Now, in fact, if you simulate the system as a classical ensemble of pairs, which we've done numerically on a computer, because we know all of the interactions of the system. Don't forget these are dipoles in an insulator. We know the G factor. We know the lattice constant, so we can put the system on a computer and calculate things like the specific susceptibility. If we go in and do that, we find that, sure enough, with this classical model of pairing off various spins, I actually can explain at least qualitatively the presence of relatively sharp features in the specific heat. However, if I go to calculate the susceptibility, as I pointed out before, the classical susceptibility in this case, of course, has also very sharp, very rocky-looking, very rocky-looking features at temperatures which are similar to the temperatures at which I saw the specific heat features. In fact, what's seen, of course, experimentally is nothing of the sort. First of all, the experimental susceptibility is bigger and it's smooth. Okay, so this classical model that I have of dividing the system up into spin pairs, which then at lower temperatures don't really do very much anymore, really doesn't describe the data. So, obviously, as I said before, there's something missing here. Quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics are particularly of a more serious sort than is just required to account for a set of two-level systems. And what's actually missing from this simple picture that I described to you are the off-diagonal terms in the dipolar interaction which mix the classical eigenstates with the spin pairs. And so what we've done is in the simulation now specifically put in the fact that there is actually a small off-diagonal matrix element present due to the higher line crystal field levels, or if you wish, there's actually a small G perp in addition to the large G parallel to the dipolar interaction. And what that does is actually it renormalizes, the first thing it does, that off-diagonal term does, is it actually renormalizes these levels. And when we put in these off-diagonal terms, actually the specific heat goes from being qualitatively in agreement with experiment to actually not having a much closer quantitative agreement. So by inserting explicitly quantum mechanics into the computation of the level scheme for these dipoles. So we started off with classical dipoles. I had them interact with classical interactions and do a classical calculation. I get this specific heat qualitatively in agreement with this, but not quantitative agreement. If I then insert quantum mechanics just for computing the levels, I then find out that I get much closer agreement between the specific heat and the experiment. However, what's interesting, if all I do is just take account of the levels and calculate the susceptibility, I still get a susceptibility which is very substantially different from the experimental susceptibility. Okay, so what I've done here is just use quantum mechanics to calculate the energy levels, just use a classical approximation to calculate susceptibility, which is sort of a reasonable modus operandi for a solid-state physicist dealing with magnetism. But there's still this huge discrepancy here, and the discrepancy grows. You can see this is a log scale, so we're dealing here with a factor of five difference between the quantum level calculation and actually what's seen experimentally. So there's still something missing.
But we've been using here this classical expression for dealing with our simulation. We actually have to, the next step, of course, is to start using quantum expression, which explicitly includes, entanglement.
I don't want you to study this formula. It's just a Van Vleck formula that
years ago,
80 years ago. But the interesting thing about the Van Vleck formula is it contains these matrix elements, which are not present in the classical calculation. These matrix elements actually appear basically as with energy denominators, they appear squared in the formula, in the actual quantum mechanical formula for the susceptibility. It's these matrix elements, which of course measure directly the entangling contributions to the wave functions. And so what we did is we actually used this correct formula, which explicitly takes account of the entangled nature of the states. In particular, it takes account of the fact that this ground state, for example, has a mixture, is mixed in with this excited state, this mixing matrix element here in front. So if we take full account of the quantum mechanics, and particularly the entanglement of the wave functions, to calculate the susceptibility, then, in fact, we get agreement between the experimental data. Remind the experimental data, the red triangles, and these solid circles, which are the simulation results. So it seems that when I'm dealing with this dilute dipolar coupled magnet, to really understand sort of the macroscopic, very trivial, very basic property, namely just the bulk susceptibility, I actually need to put in explicitly the corrections due to entanglement. These corrections due to entanglement are actually the dominant thing at low temperatures in this Ising magnet. Now, there are other things that we did, of course, which we can do using the model, and they're difficult to do using, of course, experiment, is we can actually check to see how sensitive the magnetic response is, the magnetic susceptibility, the bulk mechanics susceptibility to these entangling effects, the off-diagonal, particularly the off-diagonal part of the dipolar interaction response to the entanglement. And here we found something really, really amazing, is that if we put it, this here shows the bulk susceptibility measured as a function of this off-diagonal piece. And this is the log scale. This goes from 10, this basically ratios the off-diagonal piece of the interaction to the diagonal piece. It's going from 10 to the minus 9 to 10 to basically from 1. And what we see is actually that the calculation shows that even very, very small, off-diagonal interactions produce a huge amount of measurable entanglement in the bulk susceptibility. So already at something like 10 to the minus 6, you're actually seeing that the bulk susceptibility actually goes up by about some length factor 2. So it shows that entanglement has profound effects on this random system, and I can tell you why in random. If somebody asks me later, there's actually some very interesting things about why it is particularly random systems, disordered magnets, which are especially sensitive to entanglement effects. So I've shown you here that entanglement really matters for a very simple physical system, and the effect of entanglement is seen in the very simplest quantity that people have been measuring literally now for 150 years, simply the susceptibility measure of the coil and bulk sample. And I've shown you an indicator of entanglement which you can use when you look at sort of the bulk magnet which somebody is proposing perhaps as a candidate for some quantum information processing scheme. And that's basically looking for discrepancies between chi and the specific heat. So what chi, of course, contains the matrix elements, where specific heat simply counts states. And so if some solid-state physicist comes to you and says, hey, I have a system which has a lot of entanglement in it, maybe you should use it for some kind of a cluster state calculation, the cluster state scheme, you can ask him immediately to indicate whether he really knows what he's talking about. Say, is the bulk susceptibility, if you measure that system, very different from a specific heat, or is it the same? If it's more or less the same, the odds are is that you don't really have to think quantum mechanically to understand the ground state of that system.
So, I think here we've shown that the concepts of entanglement and dark are useful for understanding what's going on. Next question is are these concepts useful also in ordered systems? Disordered systems have peculiarities that may make it very advantageous to think about the entanglement and phase coherence effects. But is it a useful concept even in dealing with ordered systems? And here I'm going to spend the last few minutes describing a bit our recent results on the world's most famous anti-ferromagnet, which is the square lattice anti-ferromagnet. And of course, square lattice anti-ferromagnet is well known to most people in this audience as being a completely trivial thing with essentially negligible qualitative quantum corrections, and I'm going to try to convince you, of course, that the opposite is true. Of course, what you have for a Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet are simply Gale state, classical eigenstates, where each spin sees neighbors which are anti-ferromagnetically aligned with it, anti-parallel to it. That's the ground state, and then a bunch of spin waves which are indexed by K. Of course, in a real system, this is the classical limit. Now, if you're dealing with a system which is not quite classical, not quite quantum mechanical, you can of course use these classical eigenstates as a basis state to look at the real wave function for a true ground state, and of course true ground state is also the true excited states. So typically, a wave function for the system can be written as basically an L state plus essentially superposition of spin wave states and then pairs of spin waves and triplets of spin waves and so on. So that's sort of the starting point that one has. And what I'm going to discuss is whether these corrections here, these quantum corrections, are significant for something as simple as a square lattice anti-ferromagnet. And so how do we actually see these corrections? We really want to be sensitive to these higher order terms of the wave function, the non-classical terms of the wave function. And the way we do that is we do essentially a generalized magnetic susceptibility measurement using magnetic neutron scattering. Here's my two-dimensional Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet. And here is what I would see in a conventional neutron scattering experiment. Neutron scattering experiments, remember, operate in K-space, so they're well matched to ordered systems where things are, where K is a good quantum number. And of course, what you have is you have some Brillouin zone, and then you typically, of course, have an ordering vector, which is for the square lattice anti-ferromagnet, just typically called pi pi, or half a half, a Bragg peak here. From that Bragg peak emanates a spin wave cone. And then that cone blossoms out and becomes essentially a zone boundary. Should be in possible place dispersionless zone boundary mode at twice the exchange interaction. Now, we've done experiments, which it's actually shown here. Let me just move ahead here. Let me just pause here. We've done experiments where we've examined this for a particular realization of the square lattice anti-ferromagnet, which is copper formate tetrahydrate. It doesn't really matter what it is. We have a good realization which has no ring exchange terms for the supremic Schanke among us because the it's an organometallic with very, very tightly bound orbitals. And what you see here are the neutron scattering experiments where we cut through this thin wave cone at a variety of different energies. And what you see here at the first order is pretty much in agreement with the classical calculation that's shown here. Nothing special. So as you go up in energy, this cone, of course, goes from being a circle, the cross section becomes a circle, and then eventually becomes more square-like as you approach the zone boundary energy. Now, there is actually something peculiar going on, though, if you examine the zone boundary in some more detail.
But the peculiar thing that's going on is in fact, there's an anomaly. This is the classical calculation of the solid line, but there's actually an anomaly here at points such as pi over 2, pi over 2. There's a reduction here in the intensity, whereas, of course, here at the pi 0 point, you're fine.
And so this dispersion here that's seen is unexpected, this dispersion along the zone boundary. Now, where could this be coming from? And this is the first piece of evidence that we have that the wave function is seriously corrective. In fact, okay, let me just write pictorially what I showed you a minute ago. The wave function for the ground state is simply, taking the superposition of the nail state plus a correction, plus a set of correction terms, which have, for instance, flipped spins relative to the nail state. Of course, these things could be written as superpositions of spin waves, as we came before. And where could this softening come from? Well, an intuitive rationalization for the softening is shown here, is that if you now try to do neutron experiment to actually see spin waves above this state, you're actually not just flipping spins out of this particular piece of the wave function, you're also flipping spins out of that particular piece of the wave function, out of the correction. And so diagonal flips actually still cost 4 times j. Whereas flips along the 0, 1, and 1, 0 direction actually can cost less. And this tells you immediately okay, why you actually have a softening of the mode at a half of 0 at the zone boundary relative to the 1 quarter, 1 quarter. So how do we actually verify this picture? Well, we need to look at the wave functions themselves. And of course, the information about the wave functions is contained in the matrix elements, which are measured directly by neutrons. And spin wave theory, classical spin wave theory, predicts not only the energies, but also these matrix elements, or these coefficients, if you like, in the wave functions. And this shows a comparison here between spin wave theory and the amplitudes that are measured. Now, notice that there's very good agreement here as you go towards the zone center. But there's rather poor agreement out near the zone boundaries. Let me just reveal that a little bit more clearly, showing where the discrepancies are, and bringing out the discrepancies between the spin wave amplitudes, which are uncorrected for the wave function corrections in the ground state, and the actual observed amplitudes, which actually contain also terms to do with the corrections of the ground state wave function, the timing. You'll see here at these, again, at these zone boundary, along the zone boundary, there are huge corrections, in fact, 50% corrections. The spin wave amplitudes, are hugely reduced near the anomalies in the spin wave dispersion. Up here, I'm showing you the ratio of the spin wave energy that's observed, the spin wave energy that's calculated. You see the suppressed scale here, this goes just from 0.9 to 1.1. I don't need to suppress the scale here to look at the amplitude effects. The amplitude effects are truly enormous, especially near these zone boundary points here. We can actually show, in two dimensions, where these anomalies are in the intensities. What this shows you is actually the neutron data, the raw neutron data, taken at a slice going through the cone, through the dispersion, basically through a set of cones. Remember, we're dealing with a periodic crystal here, so you have the periodic repetition of the patterns in k-space as well. And so this is here a center of a magnetic zone. This is a center of a magnetic zone, Down up here are the data, down here the calculations of conventional spin wave theory for these amplitudes in k-space. As you see very beautifully, here you get very nice agreement between the theory and the experiment. And here, you see that the corners, these zone corners are actually locked off by the in the experiment relative to what you see in the calculation. Since the anomalous contributions to the wave functions, which are measured directly at these zone corners. So, make a long story short, what I've essentially shown you is that the wave function, in fact, is corrected, has substantial corrections in it
And in fact, probably one of the best shorthand ways to think of the wave function corrections are to say that you actually mix in to the nail state of this square lattice, the very substantial RVD-like or entangled bits of wave function.
Now, let me just talk just very quickly that there's actually another very deep consequence of the mixing of the classical eigenstates to form the quantum eigenstates. I've shown you the effect on the amplitudes of those spin waves, but I can also show you that in addition to spin wave amplitude corrections, you should see additional non-spin wave, like continuum modes. And we've seen these, let me just show you very quickly, we've seen these actually living inside the dispersion wave. So these are, again, direct manifestations of the correction of the classical wave function, essentially with entangling contributions, because, of course, spin a half is highly quantum mechanical, even in a square lattice in 2D. And so these are experiments where we use polarized neutrons to identify these additional multi-magnon modes, or, if you wish, the additional contributions to the scatter due to the fact that the ground state wave function itself actually has to be written as an expansion, including magnon corrections, or if you like, RVD-like corrections. So let me conclude by saying that actually entanglement is a very useful concept for the physics of solids. There are measurable consequences because of the sensitivity of magnetic susceptibilities, both at cubic bulk susceptibilities, which are measured at Q equals zero and zero frequency, but also that with neutron scattering, where you actually have access to the full momentum and energy dependent susceptibility, you can actually start measuring actual wave function corrections and back out directly what the entanglement is at a local scale in these non-trivial but very, very well-known solid state physics problems. Of course, the next step is to come back to this to come back to the QIP problem and ask the question is if we can actually control these entanglement corrections in order to use them to do something interesting like a quantum computation. Thank you very much.
Questions through the lunch break, I'm afraid. Our next speaker is Bob Clark from the University of New South Wales, who's going to talk to us.